Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour we visit a college campus and talk with a criminology student, but this man has firsthand experience in the criminal justice system, having spent 26 years behind bars, how he uses his incarceration to help classmates be more informed. We'll also learn about the latest effort to keep invasive carp out of the Great Lakes. Metro East communities saw a windfall when Illinois legalized recreational marijuana sales. So how are they faring now that Missouri, right across the river, has done the same? We'll learn how one Illinois college has become a powerhouse in women's wrestling. Locally owned bookstores, they're doing better than you might think. We'll find out more. And the airline TWA is no more, but a book details its history. We'll talk with the authors. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Johnny Del Pippins isn't like most candidates in the criminology PhD program at the University of Iowa. That's because he has firsthand experience in the criminal justice system. He served 26 years in prison before his sentence was commuted by the Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker last spring. Reporter Charlotte West has been following Pippins' story for more than 2 years. She works for the news organization Open Campus. She met up with Pippins and a couple of his classmates to discuss how incarceration informs his teaching and the role of education in making amends.
It's afternoon at Pop's, an Iowa City barbecue restaurant known for its rib tips and mac and cheese. Johnny Liddell Pippins is sitting next to Carter Hefner, a junior at the University of Iowa. Across the high top table from them is Kendall Riley, a fourth-year PhD student. They're gathered here to talk about prison education and Pippin's journey from prison to a PhD.
I made a joke in class that he saw as a teachable moment.
They're talking about the first real encounter between Pippins, who goes by Dell, and Hefner. It was in class last fall. The professor asked the class if they'd rather get a definite 10-year sentence or be given a range of 1 year to 20.
In my head, I was like, I'll take the 1 to 20. I said, you know how relaxing it would be 20 years in prison? No rent, not have to pay any bills, free food.
When Pippins heard Hefner's wisecrack, he shot up out of his seat. For most students, it might be easy to think about crime and punishment as theoretical topics of debate, not for Pippins.
I mean, I knew he was joking. But two, it was like, this was my chance to, you know, go, here's a teachable moment. Let me show you something, young man.
Pippins pulled out two IDs. One was his yellow University of Iowa student ID with the Hawkeye logo. The other was a well-worn blue ID with white lettering that read, Department of Corrections, inmate. Pippins told Hefner that less than a year ago, he'd been sitting in a prison cell about 40 miles northeast of campus, serving time for a murder. Typically, a story about a formerly incarcerated man going to college would be a story about how he was bettering himself. And it is that. Pippins got a bachelor's and a master's degree inside. But this story is also about the way Pippins is bettering the lives and education of others. He's had experiences that very few at the University of Iowa have had.
Makes me rethink, kind of makes me think, like, what he thinks about certain topics in class. Coming from my perspective, I'm like, I'm just a white kid from a small town in Iowa. I probably have a lot of different biases and ways of thinking than he does, and especially when we're learning about race, crime, and justice, someone that actually went through it, I tend to think about what does he think about every day.
You did yourself a disservice when you said you're just a kid from a small town in Iowa. I think you kind of get it, and I think that's so commendable, because we need people that don't look like me concerned with that issue.
Pippins considers sharing his story and getting other people to care as much as he does about these issues almost part of his life's work. Hefner had some questions.
Can I ask what you did? What happened?
Yeah, I will tell you what happened. We were selling drugs ourselves, and we were robbing other drug dealers the summer of 96. And we went to this one drug dealer who we had formerly been cool with. We went to his house, and I tried to shoot the lock off the door, and the bullet passed through the door and struck him in the heart, killed him instantly.
Johnny, Dallas. Is that hard to talk about?
Yeah.
I mean, I never refused to talk about it because I wanted to be a driving force in my life. And I want to remember his kids. You know, I want to remember life. You know, that you don't get to do that to Dover. You know, once that heartbeat is gone, that's over with. You kill somebody, you don't get to redo that. So now your life going forward, in my opinion, has to all be about helping folk.
Pippins isn't afraid to share his story, but like everyone else, he wants to be accepted by his university community. Kendall Riley, the first-year PhD student sitting across the high-top table, has become his mentor. They first met while Pippins was still incarcerated, and they've stayed close since he started school last fall.
People don't know what it takes to get through the PhD program unless you're told and or you have a parent that has also gone through it.
Pippin's time behind bars isn't the only thing that gives him a different perspective from most students at the University of Iowa. He and Riley are two of a small number of Black students on campus. Black men make up a quarter of the Iowa prison population, but they only make up about 1% of the Iowa student body.
There's 414 Black men here, but there's 2,100 Black men in Iowa Department of Corrections.
Riley had a pair of Black mentors who helped her navigate another predominantly white institution. And she wanted to do the same for Pippins.
When it was time for me to potentially try to demystify some of the hidden curriculum for someone else, especially another Black student, I was excited to do it.
They talk a lot about what it's like to be a Black student at a mostly white university. Sometimes the extra work it takes being one of the few students of color and being one of the only students who spent time behind bars weighs on Pippins.
There's a whole bunch of conversation, then there's something about prison. Hey, Dale, like, damn, I mean, I know something about football, you know, I know something about, you know, women's rights or something. Ask me something else than prison, like, damn, like, but then, too, I understand why, you know, I mean, you're going to ask the butcher about sirloin.
There are times when Pippins feels like he's underestimated or his experiences are dismissed. He had one professor who told him he was relying too much on his personal time inside instead of on the theories they were studying.
I got 27 years of lived experience of this stuff.
It's the ivory tower versus, you know, you standing under the ivory tower, man. I've been standing under the prison tower, man. I'm telling you what goes on.
Ultimately, Pippins feels like the struggle is worth it. His time in prison gives him insights that no one else can offer.
The reentry of prison into prison?
Carter Hefner, the student who thought 20 years in prison would be easy, he's asking the man with the experience questions about the theories he's reading in class.
How much of that is on, like, the system and the institution, and how can, like, that be changed?
Pippins nods towards Hefner as they sit at Pops, the Iowa City barbecue spot.
I think if I can help shape the thoughts of guys like this, I think I've, in some ways, made some measure of atonement for what I've done.
I'm Charlotte West.
After weathering the advent of Amazon and the closures of the pandemic, it may seem like it would be a difficult time for local bookstores. But the American Booksellers Association is actually reporting its highest membership in 20 years, nearly 300 members added since 2019. From Peoria, Colin Shope talked with some local bookstore owners to get a read on how they're adapting and thriving.
After weathering the advent of Amazon and the closures of the pandemic, it may seem like it would be a difficult time for local bookstores. But the American Booksellers Association is reporting their highest membership in 20 years, with nearly 300 members added since 2019. I spoke with some local bookstore owners to get a read on how they're adapting and thriving. The soft ring of wind chimes announces the entrance of a customer at the book rack in Peoria's Oak Cliff Shopping Center. Stacy Harden says she kept the chimes as tradition from the original owner when she took over 7 years ago. She quickly learned the ins and outs of running a bookstore in operation since the 1970s.
I think a lot of people just think that you just get the books and you throw them on the shelves and that's it. You can sit down and read all day. And it's definitely not how that works.
Harden says she can get hundreds of trade-in books a day. Each book must be cleaned, priced, inventoried, sorted, and alphabetized among the store's aisles of shelves, nooks, and crannies. Across town, Book Nook General Manager Cheryl Langley sorts through a similarly labyrinthine collection of books. Langley started at the Book Nook 8 years ago. About 4 years ago, the store began posting their entire inventory on Amazon.
Which has helped make ends meet on certain days. And, you know, unfortunately, the online business is not going to go anywhere. So we might as well just take a piece of that as well.
The book rack has also innovated in some ways over the years. Harden says she's expanded their selection of bookish merchandise, things like branded clothing, coasters, bookmarks, journals, collectibles, and more.
There are people that come in here that are not readers, but they love pop culture. They love movies that are made from books. So they come in and buy just that merchandise.
Harden estimates merchandise can make up as much as 40% of the store's sales. Harden also began branching out into new books recently. She says the popularity of BookTok, an online ecosystem of influencers making book recommendations on TikTok, makes some orders a very safe bet.
BookTok has made a huge difference in how many books we sell here at the store and how many books that we sell new. So I will get on there and see what all the hype is about, and then I will order those, and then I'll post it on social media, and then usually I've sold out of those within just a couple days.
Both stores also zero in their focus on something that's difficult or impossible for large online retailers to offer, a relationship with their customers. Langley makes a point to talk to the regulars who not only purchase books, but trade back in the books that make up the Book Nook's inventory.
We strike up conversations. How are you today? You know, how's your wife? How's your husband? You know, how are the kids? You know, and you just don't get that at big places. You're just a customer and you don't really matter, but they do. Here they're part of the family as well, and I couldn't be here without them.
This approach creates customers like Richard Hens, who has been a regular patron of the Book Nook since before Langley was manager and its expansion to 3 storefronts. He appreciates the variety that the store offers.
I like to read Clive Cussler books. I like to read Tom Clancy books. But then I also, as a biology teacher and a former biology teacher, and I like history and stuff like that, so they have a good selection of nonfiction as well.
Hens says the Book Nook is even a destination when family visits from out of state. The book rack has its own set of dedicated customers as well. Meredith Bonetta is a Peoria teacher. She's frequently at the book rack to find books for her classroom and some young adult favorites for herself.
I think it's super important for kids to see that it's locally owned. It's not some faraway thing that books and reading can be. It's local, it's close, it's feasible for everyone to come here. We're on Knoxville, everything is super close.
Then there's something more intangible that's special about a locally owned bookstore. Harden calls it a magical environment, created through decorations for genre areas like horror, mystery, and children's books. For Langley, it's the sense of discovery a used bookstore creates.
When you come to a used bookstore, you just walk around and see what jumps out at you that particular day, because the inventory is always changing. You never know what you're going to find.
And who knows? You might just find your new favorite read.
Veterinary medicine was once a profession dominated by men. In the past 15 years, though, women have become the majority of practicing vets and students. Despite the changes, some areas of the field still lag behind. Harvest Public Media's Lily Halloran looks into why rural animal practices are still largely male-dominated.
Dr. Bailey Lammers admits running her own veterinary practice in rural Nebraska can be a challenge, especially with family at home. When she first started Gavin's Point Vet, Lammer says she constantly juggled new motherhood while trying to build a stable client list.
It's a lot more challenging, I think, for the mom, especially with newborns and everything, to be away and have to go on calls in the middle of the night to, you know, pull a calf or those kinds of things.
At the start of her career, Lammers faced clients who were skeptical of her abilities. Some would even call, specifically asking for a man. Lammer says most of her clients now are really understanding that she's also got a family.
And so the ones that don't believe that I should be doing what I do because I am a mom or a woman or whatever, those are just not my clients.
While nearly 70% of practicing veterinarians are women, the percentage studying is even higher at 83%. Kate Zarni is a second-year veterinary student. She says while interning at a rural practice in Wisconsin, farmers were often uncomfortable with having a woman veterinarian make livestock calls.
They would have to go with one of their male vets first and be like, no, our vet is good. She knows what she's doing.
This is part of what inspired the University of Missouri student to become president of her school's Women's Leadership Development Initiative.
That's what this organization is focused on, is giving these leadership opportunities to women and helping them build their skills so that their confidence builds and they're ready to go take on leadership positions in their own clinics.
She says there's good reason to support female leadership in the industry because women only make up 40% of practice owners. In rural areas, the contrast is even more stark, says veterinary economist Clint Neal of Applied Economics Consulting.
Those practices tend to be smaller, much more isolated, and tend to be more geared towards working with farmers and ranchers and people in that aspect, which on the farmer and rancher side is also very male dominated as well.
Neal says this means women are unlikely to locate in rural practices, even as those areas experience a shortage of veterinarians. And women are also less likely to own a practice. Men who own their veterinary practices make up to $100,000 more per year than their female counterparts. And pay gaps also exist for specialty practices and other veterinarians.
There's like no other explanation that's not discrimination based on gender. There's none.
That's Dr. Tamara Hancock, an assistant teaching professor at the University of Missouri School of Veterinary Medicine. She says men need to be involved in pushing for pay equity as well.
It's not these women need to negotiate more. All these men were able to just negotiate themselves up tens of thousands more dollars. Like, that's just implausible to me.
Hancock says the industry still faces plenty of gendered expectations, too, despite the fact that it's now a profession with a lot more women.
You know, you pull up in your truck and they called a vet out, but they're not expecting you. And by you, I mean a woman. And you step out and they're thinking there's no way you can do this. And then there's the watch me and you do it.
Back in Nebraska, Lammers has built a practice despite those kinds of experiences. She says with the current shortage of rural veterinarians, it's something the industry needs to reckon with.
We're going to need everybody to help, you know, raise animals and keep them healthy and keep our food supply healthy.
And farmers, she says, will just have to get used to calling a woman. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Lily Halloran.
Coming up on Statewide, we'll hear how an Illinois college was able to build its women's wrestling program. That's next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. North Central College in Naperville is a small liberal arts school of fewer than 3,000 students. It also has one of the premier women's wrestling programs in the country, and that program only started 5 years ago. Peter Medlin has more on how they've become a powerhouse so quickly.
Last spring, the North Central team took home their first national title, and three Cardinal wrestlers secured individual championships on top of that. Yelena Mukayed won her third consecutive national championship in 2023 and was named the first ever USA Wrestling Women's College Wrestler of the Year. She's also one of at least six North Central women's wrestlers who will compete at the Olympic trials later this spring, with a shot to make it to the 2024 Olympic Games in Paris this July. Mukayed and NCC head coach Joe Norton understand the significance of the opportunity.
That's the pinnacle of our sport. It's not the NFL or the NBA or whatever, right? And you could go to a D3 school and qualify for the Olympic trials, right? There's not a lot of dudes going D3 and going to the NFL.
But just a few years ago, when the program just began, there was no hardware Norton could point to during the recruiting process. Just a small Division III school in the Midwest with a good men's program and without any scholarships to offer.
We were just selling dreams back then.
Mekiged remembers that pitch very well.
It's like, you know what? I love wrestling. I want to start a women's program. And we kind of just had to have faith that he would follow through.
And to make recruiting more complicated, girls wrestling wasn't an official IHSA sport at the high school level in Illinois until just 3 years ago, so there weren't many local programs to pull from. Mukayed is from California outside of Sacramento, and she didn't start wrestling until high school. Her school didn't have enough girls for their own team, so they'd practice with the boys' team and then compete against other girls in tournaments.
And I honestly liked it like that because, you know, the coaches treated us equally, the same as they treated the guys, and it was really challenging, but it made us really strong.
She says she wasn't that heavily recruited since she started so late, and she didn't really know about many programs with women's teams until she got the call from Coach Norton. And over the course of her college career, Mukied has seen women's wrestling grow exponentially. There's more opportunity in high school. There are more and more colleges at every level with women's programs. It's also listed as an emerging sport by the NCAA, meaning it's on track for an official NCAA championship soon. The North Central program has took off too. That first year in 2019, they had 9 wrestlers. Now, 52 women from nearly 24 different states and 21 All-Americans on the roster. But with the women's wrestling scene becoming stronger and stronger, that comes with new challenges for a small school like North Central. Division III schools can't offer athletic scholarships. And Norton says they're competing against Division I and II programs who can offer full ride scholarships and high-end gear sponsorships. But Norton stresses the scholarship doesn't make you a better wrestler. It's the coaches and the training.
Well, coach, this school is free. I'm on a full ride. All right. Well, that doesn't put you in the Olympic trials. That doesn't put you on top of the podium at the NCAA championships.
And the competition is tougher. This year, the University of Iowa started a women's program. Mukied says that's a huge deal. Iowa has one of the most successful Division I men's programs in the nation. Imani Jones, another All-American on the team, says competing against the likes of Iowa keeps them motivated. They still have something to chase, even when they're the defending national champions.
We just won the national tournament, and like I feel like we don't have the credit we deserve still, so everyone expects them to win, so I like it that we still are like the underdog going after them.
The Cardinals clinched their second consecutive regional title recently, and the North Central team looks to bring home back-to-back championships at the national tournament coming up March 8th and 9th. Just 5 years ago, Coach Norton was selling dreams to Mukied and the other women joining the brand new program. Now, those Olympic dreams are reality, and the national championships are on the shelf, and the chance to compete at the highest level is right in front of them. I'm Peter Medlin.
Before last year, many Missouri residents traveled across the Mississippi River to buy recreational marijuana in Illinois. But in the year since Missouri legalized it, what has that meant for the Illinois Metro East dispensaries and communities? Will Bauer takes a look.
Few cities across the state of Illinois benefited from recreational marijuana quite like Collinsville. It was the first in the Metro East to open a dispensary in January 2020.
Looking right now, I'd say there's probably a good half-mile long line of people. And when we got here,
Charles Walters was like many in the St. Louis Metro that morning in 2020. He made the trip early to Collinsville to buy something he could only get there. And in the first couple of years, the city of Collinsville made well over $1 million in sales tax from recreational marijuana. But the market has gotten more saturated since then. 1 year ago, the competition really grew when Missouri dispensaries opened their doors. For Collinsville, the city went from making $1.3 million in sales tax in 2021 to about $780,000 last year. City manager Derek Jackson says they expected it.
Once Missouri legalized, there were folks, you know, that were obviously traveling across the river to come to us. We knew that our volume would likely go down, you know, because those folks, it's more convenience.
Collinsville has used the money for capital improvement projects, like fixing sewers, roads, or replacing old vehicles. Now, there's just less cash than the past couple of years.
It's not like there's any layoffs or any reduction in services that he provides its residents and businesses. It's just less of a boon for our capital projects.
For Sojay, something similar happened. The village was making about $55,000 per month on its sales tax for marijuana. Last year, that figure dropped to about $23,000. The marijuana sales tax revenue allowed Village Mayor Rich Sojay Jr. and the police union to strike a contract deal back in 2022.
Due to this influx of revenue, we had probably our largest increase of our payroll for the police department that we'd ever had done before.
But unlike Collinsville and Sojay, one Metro East community outperformed expectations. Fairview Heights.
And I've had people ask, what was the impact since Missouri has opened their dispensaries? And to be honest, we have seen little or no impact.
Fairview Heights Mayor Mark Kupski says the city has made around $1 million in sales tax each year from recreational marijuana. This fiscal year, they're on track to hit that mark, even after Missouri legalized. And there might be a few reasons why Fairview Heights performed better. Collinsville had sold so much in the first few years that it was bound to see a drop. Another possibility for Collinsville is that it just didn't get more Missouri competition last year. Three other Madison County cities all got dispensaries too. Justin Leiby, an accounting professor at the University of Illinois, says when Missouri opened up for business last February, Illinois sales dropped about 30%. Leiby says he honestly expected more. Oddly enough, the data actually suggests some Missourians are still coming to Illinois.
I would have expected nobody is any longer going to be coming from Missouri to Illinois to purchase cannabis, simply because a lot of the products are going to be the same and it's cheaper in Missouri.
And one of the biggest reasons that weed is cheaper west of the Mississippi comes back to the tax rates, and Missouri's is less for recreational. But Kupski with Fairview Heights says he wonders how much consumers make decisions based on the sales tax.
I think at the end of the day, people are going to shop just like any of us. We buy groceries at a certain place because we like the selection, we like the service, we like the people that help us. It's convenient to our homes.
And Leiby, the accounting professor, says the tax rate does matter, but maybe not as much as some think it does. Changes to state taxes is a decision that state lawmakers would need to take up. In the meantime, St. Louis area consumers will continue to make their own choices about where they buy their marijuana. I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
The Army Corps of Engineers plans to build a $1 billion high-tech barricade on the Des Plaines River. The goal is to deter invasive carp from traveling farther up Illinois' waterways and reaching Lake Michigan. Scientists worry there is increasingly an opportunity for the carp to make it through and turn the lake upside down. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco has more.
In Joliet, Scott Whitney with the Army Corps of Engineers stands on a peninsula of the Des Plaines River carved out nearly a century ago to make way for the Brandon Road lock and dam. He's pointing out a giant red barge floating along.
So this is petroleum barges, and you'll see that's the predominant. There's a big mobile plant just upriver here.
Whitney says on any given day, about 15 barges carrying oil products pass through here. The river has been a major economic highway since Illinois decided to break open the Great Lakes to the Mississippi River in the 1800s with a system of canals. Joining the two watersheds turned Illinois into a major connector for a trade route from the Gulf of Mexico out past Canada. Every year, hundreds of tons of goods and commodities worth billions of dollars flow through the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. But then in the 1990s, the invasive carp arrived.
45 miles downriver from where we stand right now, they just hauled in 1 million pounds of this silver carp in a single netting. They used a seine haul, and 1 million pounds of fish were pulled in and brought in.
There are stretches of the Illinois River where the invasive carp make up over 80% of the biomass. Some researchers say that now there's more carp here than anywhere else on the planet. Invasive carp is a shorthand for a family of fish that can outeat, outgrow, and outreproduce native fish. They're giant. Whitney says it's not just other fish feeling the pressure. Carp can make life impossible for boaters, as they're able to leap several meters out of the water and knock out unassuming passersby.
It's really a not safe situation, but ecologically, I think the bigger impact is what it's going to have in changing the whole dynamics of the fishery in the Great Lakes.
Which is why the Army Corps wants to build a $1.1 billion obstacle course-like defense system against the encroaching fish that includes an electric barrier, sonic blasts, a bubble wall, and a flushing lock that would prevent the carp from swimming upstream. The project could take anywhere from 6 to 8 years at a minimum to complete. Carp could decimate the entire recreational and commercial fishing industry that has sprung up around the lakes. However, the carp in the Illinois River haven't moved closer to Chicago in about a decade. That's according to University of Illinois professor Corey Suski.
So the fish at the leading edge are showing signs of increased exposure to contaminants that's not present in the fish that are farther downstream.
Researchers have theorized that Chicago's waterway pollution has kept the carp in check for years. So in a lab, Suski and collaborators tested how young silver carp performed. They found that the carp's behavior was off, and just inhabiting the upstream water required more energy than usual. As the water gets cleaner, the pollution barrier becomes more uncertain.
There's a lot of work going on to improve the water quality, and if something does change, we could maybe start to see a change in the movement of the carp.
There's already 180 invasive species in the Great Lakes, according to Molly Flanagan. She's with the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Flanagan says the carp could turn Lake Michigan into a pathway to spread.
The concern is invasive carp get into the lakes via the Chicago waterway, and then they move into rivers and streams in the Great Lakes region, and they can use those as highways to get into other Great Lakes.
Scott Whitney, who I met with in Joliet, told me on the phone later that the Army Corps of Engineers says that's why construction on the mega project is necessary.
You know, rarely do we have opportunities like this to really stop something in its tracks.
Because once the invasive carp are here, they're here to stay. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
Water sources in agricultural areas across much of the Midwest often show high levels of nitrate. Federal standards require drinking water to stay below 10 parts per million. But a growing number of studies suggest lower levels of nitrate could still be tied to serious health issues. For Side Effects Public Media, Natalie Krebs has more.
It was the middle of January in 2011 when 16-year-old Jacob Peters developed a bad cough. Doctors initially diagnosed him with an upper respiratory infection. But when Jacob didn't improve, his father, Gary Peters, says they started feeling around his son's neck.
And then they ordered a chest x-ray and found a 3-inch tumor right below his collarbone that was compressing his trachea.
Jacob, an active, healthy teen who played multiple sports, was diagnosed with an aggressive type of cancer. He passed away less than a year later while undergoing chemotherapy. The Peters family lives in Aurora, Nebraska, a small rural farming community in the central part of the state. Gary says in the years surrounding Jacob's illness, multiple kids in Aurora were diagnosed with cancer, which was strange because childhood cancer overall is really rare.
An average class size in Aurora is probably 90 to 100 kids, somewhere in there. And so when you have 7 kids at one time that have cancer, that's a pretty big deal.
Gary says it's unclear what caused all these kids to get sick, probably a number of factors. But one possibility continues to bother him. What if it's something in the water?
There is no scientific causality. There is no proof that anything in the water is causing this, but it's awfully suspicious.
About a decade ago, a team of researchers at the University of Nebraska Medical Center started looking into this possibility of a connection between water quality and pediatric cancer. They looked at rural Nebraska watersheds. They found a correlation between pediatric cancer and higher rates of nitrate from farm fertilizer, as well as an herbicide called atrazine. Eleanor Rogan is a public health researcher for the ongoing study. She says it's noteworthy the watersheds that correlated with higher cancer rates often had nitrate levels below the US EPA's current safe contaminant level of 10 parts per million.
So that's what leads us to say, well, maybe this 10 isn't such a great idea. It should really be lower. And other people have found the same thing.
The nitrate standard was set decades ago to prevent blue baby syndrome. Even so, it is common for farming communities across the Midwest to have elevated levels of nitrate that still meet federal standards. Recent studies have linked nitrate with other health issues like colorectal cancer and thyroid disease. But Mary Ward, a senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health and a leading expert on nitrate, says it's still too early to make any firm conclusions.
We really need more ongoing studies to study this connection between nitrate and health, including specific cancers and adverse reproductive outcomes.
The EPA has started to look into this issue. Nitrate is scheduled for a health reassessment that could lead to a lower standard. The agency initially slated that study for 2017, but put it off. Dave Swertney is an environmental health expert at the University of Iowa.
I will say I worry a lot, like if in 15, 20 years, the evidence becomes more conclusive and we realize that things like nitrate do cause cancer with certainty, we're going to feel really bad about how long we've sort of had an inkling and not acted on it.
Meeting the EPA's current nitrate standard is already difficult for many communities. Reverse osmosis systems that filter nitrate from water are incredibly expensive. Experts like Don Coulter are also concerned about this aspect. He's a pediatric oncologist at the University of Nebraska Medical Center who's involved in the ongoing nitrate study.
The problem of nitrate, whether it's at 10 parts per million or if the EPA decides to lower it to 8 parts per million or 6 parts per million, that problem is going to be sent on then to those small communities who are going to have to absorb the cost.
Coulter says that's why it's important that officials put resources behind helping rural communities and farmers to make drinking water safer. Natalie Krebs, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a health reporting collaboration of NPR member stations across the Midwest. Stay with us here on Statewide. Later, we will remember Trans World Airlines. We'll talk with the authors of a book on TWA. That's ahead. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, remembering the airline TWA. But first, a state lawmaker who represents rural central Illinois between Bloomington and Springfield is helping to negotiate a new state budget. State Senator Sally Turner says she was appointed to the Senate Republicans' budget negotiating team because of her 24 years of experience as the Logan County Clerk. Turner says she's opposed to the $800 million in tax increases in the budget plan, that is mostly from taxes on corporations and gambling. Turner says she'd like to see the state eliminate health care funding for undocumented immigrants. But Turner, who spoke with Eric Stock, says there is plenty in the budget she supports and her constituents need.
Those things consist of education priorities. You know, we want to make sure that child's whole and their well-being and of our children in general. And also, one of the things that we've been lacking that we'd like to see more of, and that's for our disabled community. We've seen cuts in that in the past, and we want to make sure that those get supplemented the way that they need to. That was one of the other big issues. And then also, as we see the need for families, right now people are hurting, especially in the energy area. A lot of people we see are having problems with their bills. In our district office, we have people that come in often and need our assistance. And where do I go? I need help. I need help with my, whether it's with their energy. I can't pay my prescription bills along with my getting my food. We try and navigate and try and send them to the proper agencies. So those agencies that assist with that, we need to make sure they get funded as well.
Does the governor's budget plan, about $52.7 billion, substantially address the concerns that you were hearing about in those main priority areas?
Yes, some of those areas, yes. Regarding education, and we know that that increase needed to be made, as it's been specified in law, and also in higher education. There's some areas, though, in which we can segue into maybe something else that you want to discuss, and that was in regard to what we talked about transparency in the budget. Presently, the transparency regarding migrant funding, and then what is in the budget as well for supplementing that cause. So that's part of the things that are probably in that budget that we'd just like to know where they're coming from.
Now, the governor did say in his address that he would ask the General Assembly for about $182 million to cover most of migrant services. The city of Chicago and Cook County would shoulder the rest. So are you suggesting the number is actually higher than that? Or where is the transparency question?
It is higher than that. What we're seeing is probably $1 billion that has been overall is being asked for to help supplement those issues that come to migrant funding. It might have been asking for that 182, but in what area and what's the previous amount that you've already used to supplement that? And what is it that you're asking for in addition to the 182? Is it in one specific area? But we know it's going to be billions of dollars to make that happen the way that he's been suggesting.
Where do you believe the funding is showing up in the budget elsewhere to account for this?
Great point. That's exactly what we're asking. Just show us where that is in the budget so that we can also understand the what your ideas are and where they're coming from and what areas within the different agencies that you're taking the money from and supplementing it to.
But what evidence do Senate Republicans have to suggest that that is already being done, that it's being couched in other departments within the budget to sort of mask it?
Exactly, Eric. We don't. But as a citizen, and then as myself and the other representatives, they're representing the people in our districts. I think we need to know. We just need to know how those things are being spent. You know, when I was a county clerk, That was something that we made sure that we did. We had committee meetings, and we had the agencies come in and tell us, this is what my needs are, this is what I'm spending it on. And then through the finance committee, we approve those things. And I know that's local government, it's a little bit different, but it's the same idea, this representative to the people, and we're responsible to tell them how we're spending their money.
But what makes Senate Republicans believe that that spending is actually the billions of dollars for migrant funding?
Well, and again, we don't know. And it's not just on the migrant funding. There's all kinds of things we want to know. And but one of the other things that we want to know is, you know, how much money you're spending on non-citizens, but also how is it that it's continually the executive orders in the way that you're doing it right now? And let's bring that to the legislature and allow them to make some decisions along with you.
Let's say it is $182 million for migrant services. Would that be something that you and Senate Republicans would support?
To be quite honest, I don't know how much this costs at all. I have not been provided with those numbers, so I can't speculate on whether or not those numbers would be correct. So right now, we just know it's a lot of money for folks that aren't here legally. And we have people all the time that are coming in and struggling. We have people from different pockets of, I know my 44th district, some of the areas, the entire area, the kids have to have meals because none of them can afford it. So our people need to be represented equally.
Is there a certain amount of funding that you would support for services for asylum seekers and those who have been bussed here from Texas to Illinois?
I will say this. Absolutely, we have compassion for the people that are here. Unbeknownst to them, what it was going to be like, you know, when they came over, I'm sure that they had these expectations that it was okay. I wasn't coming over illegally. Someone was taking me over the border and taking me to a place that where I was going to thrive and my family is going to thrive. And that is not what happened to them. You know, and here they are. They need food and they need clothing. And I think that's exactly how we need to help. It's here. It's present. We need to help with that part of it.
As we continue on with State Senator Sally Turner, a part of the Senate budget negotiation team that is now actively at work reviewing the governor's proposed budget, the governor has proposed permanently eliminating the grocery tax. Now, the public seems to love this. Some communities have said that this will have a negative impact on their funding. What do you make of it?
Yeah, we've had been approached by the Illinois Municipal League, which that's, of course, represents all the cities in our areas, the municipalities. And our understanding is that if that's eliminated, then that indeed hurts those cities and the things that they're doing with that present tax. And one of the things is that we have a bill in order to make some changes with that. So that's one area. But in regard to that whole idea about the grocery tax, one of the things is that those municipalities have been, some of the money that they generally receive from the state is being taken from them right now. And they just want to be resupplemented with what they are supposed to have. And I think if that was even, that might be a different story, but it's not. And so they are not made whole.
The last several state budgets have been approved with less rancor than we've seen in years past, particularly under J.B. Pritzker's predecessor, Bruce Rauner. Do you anticipate that will be the case this year?
No. And one thing I will say is that I believe last year our Republican and Democrat Senate, when we got together, they did a good job at having discussions together. And that was probably the first time I've heard that it's happened in a while. And I appreciate them allowing us to take part in it. Now, did we get everything that we would like to? No. Did we get some of the things? Maybe they listened to some of our issues. Sure. And I believe that our Senate, we get along very well. We're able to have good discussions with each other, and I appreciate that.
Republican State Senator Sally Turner, she spoke with Eric Stock. She represents a district that stretches from the Springfield area to Bloomington. The state of Illinois is finally making available $18.5 million to assist and protect witnesses of violent crime. Mawa Iqbal tells us more.
Illinois lawmakers passed a bill almost 2 years ago to reimburse police departments and state's attorneys for relocating witnesses, covering costs for utilities, mental health treatment, and more. Then last year, Governor J.B. Pritzker allocated $30 million to the program. But the money wasn't made available until now. Aditi Singh with the Alliance for Safety and Justice says her group still doesn't know why the state has taken so long to give out the money.
Survivors need a lot of support after going something traumatic like that. And just like knowing what's fully available is just always more helpful than not.
Grant applications opened up for law enforcement officials last month. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Trans World Airlines had one of its largest hubs at St. Louis's Lambert International Airport. Two authors with in-depth access to the TWA corporate archives have detailed the airline's history. Daniel Rust and Alan Hoffman spoke with reporter Wayne Pratt about the book Come Fly With Me, The Rise and Fall of Trans World Airlines.
What makes TWA so compelling to want to write a book about it?
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Trans World Airlines had one of its largest hubs at St. Louis Lambert International Airport. Two authors with in-depth access to the TWA corporate archives in St. Louis have detailed the airline's history. Daniel Rust and Alan Hoffman spoke to St. Louis Public Radio's Wayne Pratt about Come Fly With Me, The Rise and Fall of Trans World Airlines.
What makes TWA so compelling to want to write a book about it?
This is Daniel. Today, many people don't even recognize the name Trans World Airlines, but in the 20th century, it was a premier airline, one of the world's largest airlines, and exemplified the new technology of air travel and the allure, the drama of air travel.
This is Alan. TWA is kind of paradigmatic of the airline history of the United States. In particular, kind of the glory days of the 1950s and the 1960s, when the airlines were really doing everything they could to make flying as enjoyable and even exciting as possible.
The airline placed one of its largest hubs in St. Louis. What was behind that decision?
Transcontinental Air Transport, or TAT. This airline was developed in late 1920s when it was still not seen as practical to fly at night. So it was an air-rail combination. So it took 48 hours to travel across the country on TAT. St. Louis was strategic for them because Charles Lindbergh was one of the key figures of TAT and, of course, very famous in St. Louis. Fast forwarding to deregulation, TWA's opportunity to consolidate their operations into St. Louis and to not try to compete in the congested hub at O'Hare in Chicago, made a very targeted effort to build up Lambert Airport as their primary domestic hub with international hub at JFK in New York.
What finally ended the airline?
Carl Icahn hammered the last nails into the coffin of TWA. All of the U.S. airlines, of course, suffered extreme financial distress as a result of airline deregulation. A number of old airlines went totally bankrupt. Perhaps the most striking of all was TWA's great rival, Pan American. TWA managed to last for another 10 years, largely through the dedication of the airline's employees, who were dedicated to trying to keep the airline going and make it survive and even succeed.
How would you describe the history of this airline in just a few short sentences?
TWA is almost like a case study of an airline that succeeded wildly early on due to the dedication and vision of its leadership, and then would persevere through a very tumultuous period in the later 20th century with leadership that was really putting other interests first besides the airline itself.
TWA was created, nurtured, and then destroyed by these three larger-than-life personalities, Charles Lindbergh, of course, Howard Hughes, Carl Icahn, who kind of epitomized the greed is good culture of the 1980s. So TWA is kind of a story of these three characters who made the airline what it was and then ultimately contributed to its undoing.
Come Fly With Me, The Rise and Fall of Trans World Airlines. That is the book. Co-authors Daniel Rust and Alan Hoffman. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Wayne.
Yes, thank you.
That will wrap up this week's episode of Statewide. Thanks for being along and join us again next time. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.